for everyone who loves books. This is Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we're recording live at the Wigtown Book Festival.
And coming up today, Anthony McGowan will be telling me about The Art of Failing. Sean Bithell will be telling Red about The Diary of a Bookseller. Christopher Brookmeyer on Want You Gone. And De Courcy will be husband hunting. Adam McQueen will be telling us some lies. And Peggy Hughes gives us the books of her life. So we're in the same place at the same time. We're in the Wigtown Book Festival. Red, what are your impressions so far?
Well, now it's stopped raining and the sun's come out. It is a glorious place to be, full of great authors, happy readers, and a general sense of a love of books.
But first, let's hear from Artistic Director Adrian Turpin on the history of the Wigtown Book Festival.
Wigtown Book Festival has been going on for 19 years now, and we're in a little town in the middle of Dumfries and Galloway, in the middle of the Dumfries and Galloway countryside, very beautiful around here. It started as a community regeneration project, social and economic regeneration, in a town that had been blighted by unemployment when the local distillery and the local creamery closed. So we've always been very much, even though we're a professionally run festival, we have a lot of volunteers, and we've always had a big community input and community interest. So for people here, I think it's very much, it feels like on the 10 days of the festival every autumn, it's a bit like the circus has come to town. And we have 200 this year, just over, well, 270 events this year, I think, and they range from all sorts of things, from traditional book events and serious things and funny things and comedy and theatre and music. So there's a lot there for everyone, really.
And as a blind person myself, it is the most accessible festival I think I've ever been to.
Yeah, we've been working quite hard on accessibility, and I'm very aware that, you know, shouldn't be complacent about these things, and that we, you know, quite a lot of times we don't get it right. But I think it's become quite mainstream in our thinking recently, particularly with, you know, working with the festival charity, Fight for Sight has made a difference. So it's something that we now, I hope, build into our plans at an early level, and it becomes one of the, when you're organising an event, it becomes one of the questions that's there. And it doesn't necessarily mean we can solve every problem all the time, but it does mean that we're you know, it's on our radar, and I think that's a step forward for a medium-sized organisation like us.
And you've got some wonderful volunteers who are always at hand to help everyone. I've for the last couple of days, I've been guided round to make sure I get to the right event and speak to the right authors by Mary and then Simon, who, one thing that's really struck me is their willingness to learn what my needs might be, although they've clearly given it quite a bit of thought before taking on the responsibility of not losing me.
Sure. I mean, having that big volunteer team who are so dedicated really helps. And although obviously our aim is to try and make the experience of people with sight loss or whatever coming to the festival as near as possible to what everybody else's experience is, we do also have that provision that, you know, we really invite people to come and, if they have particular needs, to come and talk to us beforehand. Obviously, we have an access information sheet and things like that, but give us a ring and talk to us, and we will see if there's anything that we can possibly do to make it easier. In terms of access this year, one of our big projects has actually been about hearing loss, which is obviously, I mean, there is a small community of deaf people in Dumfries and Galloway, but also we find that because a lot of our audience are, you know, of a certain age, and because the acoustics are not necessarily always of their best, that we felt we needed extra provision. I mean, it's all very well having, for example, a loop system, but, you know, that makes the assumption that people are already at that stage of loss, whereas they can be having problems before that. So this year we've been working with Stage Text, who provide the most astonishing, I think, surtitling service. I mean, I think there's a quote from Arthur C. Clarke, you know, the famous quote from Arthur C. Clarke that says, you know, all successful technology aspires to the quality of magic. And when you watch these surtitles and they're absolutely instantaneous coming up on the on the screen. And what we found, which is very interesting, is that although obviously there are certain people who would never have been able to come to those events, we did it over one weekend on the first weekend. Sadly, you know, we can't do it all the time just for financial reasons. But we found that although we were getting completely new people, also a lot of our existing audience were saying, you know, well, I can pick up the couple of words that, you know, I would otherwise have missed. So it's a very good example of how, by providing better access and better provision for a specific group of people, you're actually also helping a much larger group of people.
Red Sail, talking to Wigtown Book Festival Artistic Director Adrian Turpin. As Adrian said, the partner charity of the book festival is Fight for Sight, and who also sponsored Red's presence in Wigtown. He spoke to Michelle Acton, Chief Executive of Fight for Sight, and asked her if she was enjoying the festival.
We're having a great time, actually. There are some fantastic authors. There have been some really, really good events this year, and despite the rain on the first 2 days, the sun has come out, and it's absolutely glorious here in Wigtown.
Which events have you particularly enjoyed?
Well, I have to say I did enjoy the event around the development of a whiskey tube map, which will teach people about drinking whiskey and the different flavours and the different tastes, and help people understand, in a sense, what whiskies they might like and which ones they should run a mile from. But I guess this really is a literary festival. And so actually one of the really good events that I went to today was to listen to Anne de Courcy, who was talking about the husband hunters of the 1880s and 1890s.
These are the women who came across from the United States looking for a broke baronet to save.
That's absolutely right. It was that wonderful melding of American money with British aristocracy.
And which events have Fight for Sight sponsored this year, apart from sponsoring my presence here, for which many, many thanks?
Well, we're really pleased to be able to sponsor you here, and hope that you have got lots of interviews with fantastic authors. But we're also sponsoring Jeremy Bowen, who's going to be speaking at the end of the week. So we're really looking forward to that. He's been a great supporter of Fight for Sight. So it's lovely that actually we'll be able to sponsor his event here in Wigtown on Saturday.
I'm sitting here in the glorious sunshine, wearing my sunglasses, having taken your advice during National Eye Health Week to save what little sight I have left. What did you do during National Eye Health Week?
There were two key things at Fight for Sight that we were trying to promote during National Eye Health Week. The first was very much to ensure that people do have eye tests. We know how important eye tests are. It's not just actually to correct vision, it's to pick up different eye diseases and conditions, some of which actually you can have for a while and not know that you have. And if through those you lose sight, sometimes we can't get that back. So it's incredibly important to have an eye test. Other things can also be picked up too, other health conditions. So the first thing we've been doing in National Eye Health Week is raising the profile of why it's important to have an eye test. And the second thing that we've been highlighting is very much about the safe use of contact lenses. There are 4.2 million people in the UK who wear contact lenses, most of whom look after them really well. But we do know that people are putting their eyes at risk of eye infections by keeping their lenses in for too long, swimming in their lenses. And actually, one of the really sort of no-nos about contact lenses is washing them in water. So we've been trying to raise the profile to ensure that actually people have a much greater understanding of how best they can look after their contact lenses to avoid getting eye infections.
Well, very important messages. And thank you, Michelle.
Thank you very much, Red.
Red Sail, talking to Chief Executive of Fight for Sight, Michelle Acton. This edition of Read On Air has been recorded on location at the Wigtown Book Festival. And still to come, Adam McQueen will be telling us about some great political lies. Anne de Courcy will be husband hunting. Christopher Brookmeyer on his book Want You Gone. We'll be hearing what goes on behind the scenes at a bookshop. But right now, here is my conversation with Anthony McGowan about his really hard to describe book, The Art of Failing.
Well, it's almost definitively a hard book to describe. It's one of the great challenges in getting it published and getting it sold in the first place. It's not quite a novel, not quite a journal, not quite a diary. What it is a bit of all of those different things. It's an account of a year I spend wandering aimlessly around my part of London, West Hampstead, having bizarre and surreal thoughts, having odd encounters. And in the background, there's a kind of a narrative, which is the mental disintegration of the narrator, i.e. me, and the possible collapse of his marriage, which may or may not be saved at the end. And the it's got kind of characters in the way that a novel has. My two children are quite important, and my little white fluffy dog, Monty, is quite an important character in it.
And I believe it was cut down from 500,000 words to the form we have published just now.
Yes, the first version was enormous. It was an almost hour-by-hour description of my life over a couple of years. So the first version was 500,000 words, which had a kind of weight and a power to it that much, but it was so unwieldy, it's probably unpublishable. So the final version that emerged is almost like a greatest hits version of the original.
Were you worried about how open and exposed you were going to be after publishing this?
I should probably be more worried about it. I suppose I put it out of my mind, because in some ways it does totally reveal the inner workings of my head. And there's a lot of stuff about my family and my emotional life. But I suppose there's certain ways in which I've put a distance in that I've tried to be funny, and humour is always a way of kind of making pain less painful. And also I think if you read it, you're never quite sure which bits are absolutely true and which bits are me going off on a kind of bizarre, mad fantasy. So that's another kind of insulating layer. it is quite exposing. It does. And I think I said before that in some ways, when I wrote it, I thought I was purely writing a funny book. But when I've read it subsequently, what's come out most strongly is the poignancy and the sadness in it. So maybe it was more revealing than I thought it was going to be.
You gave a statistic during a talk that I've just seen about how much is true.
Yes, 90% is 100% true. So most of the book is literally, it's me trying to accurately describe the things that happened, although they're all given a bit of a comic twist and spin. And even the remaining 10%, there's a kind of element of truth there. It begins with something that perhaps really happened, and then I'll spin it off into various odd directions. But pretty well it's a true book, or as true as imagination can make it. One of the sections of the book is about me back in the early 1990s, interviewing Anthony Burgess, one of my absolute heroes, a genuinely great, great novelist, really fascinating character. And I went to meet him in a rather faded hotel in Mayfair, where he had a suite with his wife, a Contessa. And it was quite early in the morning, and he offered me whiskey as soon as I came in. I was a young writer at the stage. I was only in my early 20s. Whiskey and kippers he gave me. So I had this kind of whiskey and kippers happening inside me. And also, when I rang the bell, his wife showed me in. And I sat in the suite and waited for Anthony to appear. And he came out looking a bit flustered. And then he sat down, and this look of anguish went across his face. And I didn't quite know what happened. Had I done something wrong? And then he put his hand down the front of his trousers and pulled out his spectacles. And I think what happened was he'd been on the loo when I rang the bell, reading on the loo, and he put the glasses inside and pulled his trousers up with the glasses inside. So it was a kind of slightly comical beginning. But anyway, it was a really brilliant interview he did. He was so interesting, so funny, so wide-ranging. And then when I got home, I realised I forgot to press the record button on the recorder. And so this amazing archive was just gone. I had to try and invent it afterwards. I don't know how long it can last. October the 27th. I heard a sound like a sigh this morning. No, more complicated. A sigh with bones in it. Almost the sound of a medium-sized bird, a wood pigeon or a crow, say, making a messy landing in the top of a tree. I investigated and saw that our drying rack had collapsed under the weight of the clothes. It's one of those foldable ones that look like the fossilised skeleton of a prehistoric accordion. I felt oddly privileged to have actually witnessed, orally, the collapse. Usually that sort of domestic disaster happens when you're out or otherwise unaware, and you just discover the horror later. Somehow this felt special. I was looking at the pile of bones and ragged flesh, okay, mainly my underpants, T-shirts and some towels, when I realised Mrs. McGee was at my shoulder. "I'll have to get a new one," she said. I had the feeling that she might have been looking at me rather than the broken rack. "I can fix things," I said, and my voice may have cracked a little. It can't be fixed. Then she left for work. I spent the day binding and splinting the broken leg, and I found myself uttering soothing words. There, there. It's okay. Shush now, shush. It's standing again now, but I don't know how long it can last.
So do you listen to the audiobooks yourself?
Audiobooks are a huge part of my life now, because I cycle and walk around a lot, and so the whole time I've got an audiobook playing in my head. I think I now enjoy books more that I listen to than ones I read, and it's become almost my main way of consuming literature. Mm-hmm. And definitely, you know, there's a skill. It took me a couple of years to learn, I think, how to properly listen to an audiobook. It's quite a complex thing to get all that information orally in your head. But once I'd acquired that skill, it's transformed my life. I would happily now, and this is a really odd thing to say because my whole life's been built around books, reading and writing them. Now I would happily, for the rest of my life, listen to books rather than read them.
This is an RNIB talking book.
I love talking books. I don't know what my life would be without them. I love travel books. I love all the people that travel the world and tell us what they've done. It's the one freedom I really have, is to read the books that I love and people doing things in the world. You just get absolutely drawn into the story. And it's difficult to get to your bed sometimes. I think talking books is the best thing ever.
Talking Books on RNIB Connects Radio. RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
Listening to Read On Air, recorded on location at the Wigtown Book Festival. Still to come, private eye journalist Adam McQueen on some big political lies, and Andy Corsi will be husband hunting. But first, let's go behind the scenes of the bookshop in Wigtown.
So, I'm delighted to be joined by Sean Biffle, who owns The Bookshop in Wigtown, one of the many bookshops, but this one is The Bookshop, and he has just had his Diary of a Bookseller published. So, Sean, tell us what it's all about.
Essentially, it's the sort of minutiae, the day-to-day humdrum of what happens in a secondhand bookshop, and it's written every day there's an entry, and it explains the sort of mechanics of how the business works. And I think the thing that people seem to like about it is the customer interactions, because you do have some very odd conversations with people in bookshops, which you probably don't get in other sorts of retail.
Such as?
Well, you always get the hagglers every day. Today I've had one, someone who found a book for £220 and wanted it for £150. So that's pretty much a feature of the day-to-day running of the business. I don't know, but a lot of people come in looking for a book, you say you haven't got it, and then they carry on telling you why they want it, and at which point I think, why are you wasting my time? Things like that. I suppose because every interaction's different, you know, you get the same patterns occurring, but such as the hagglers, but everyone does it differently, and some people are quite polite and friendly, and other people are quite rude and aggressive. So I suppose it's an attempt to show some of the range of the way people behave towards other people. But although I do give specific details, I like to think it's an eye-opener on the way people can behave and how rude some people are capable of being.
The first customer at 10:30 a.m. was one of our few regulars, Mr. Deacon. He is a well-spoken man in his mid-50s, with the customary waistline that accompanies inactive middle-aged men. His dark, thinning hair is combed over his pate in the unconvincing way that some balding men try to persuade others that they still retain a luxuriant mane. He is smartly enough dressed, inasmuch as his clothes are clearly well-cut, but he does not wear them well. There is little attention to details such as shirt tails, buttons, or flies. It appears as though someone has loaded his clothes into a cannon and fired them at him. And however they have landed upon him, they have stuck.
And everybody's talking about it. I have heard people reading out passages and guffawing with laughter. Clearly, it's very much caught the imagination of this book town and further afield.
I very much hope so, because selling books is not an easy business. But I'm delighted that you've heard good reports of it, because I haven't really... I'm so immersed in it that I can't see it objectively anymore. It's just a thing. I'm glad people seem to be enjoying it, and it is coming out as an audiobook as well.
Fantastic. In the near future, is it being recorded now?
It's being recorded right now. So I can't remember who the actor is who's reading it, but apparently he's quite highly regarded. And the rights, there was a little competition for the audio rights between Audible and another audiobook production company whose name I forget. And in the end, I decided not to go with Audible because they're owned by Amazon. And most of the book is, a theme running through the book is the destructive force that Amazon has exerted on an awful lot of business, but certainly bookshops have really suffered.
And you have met force with force. I have heard that you've made a few videos about the much-loathed Kindle.
Correct, yes. I've done three or four videos that at the first few seconds you would think it's an instruction tutorial on how to repair a damaged Kindle. And in the end, I've shot one with a 12-bore. I've hammered one to pieces with a huge hammer, and I've set fire to one to turn it into a Kindle fire. Hello and welcome to another Kindle tutorial. This time I'm going to be showing you how to convert an ordinary Kindle, in this case a broken one, into a Kindle Fire, which is Amazon's flagship Kindle. Kindle Fire is Amazon's equivalent of the Apple iPad, which I have here. And with one very simple operation, we can convert this broken ordinary Kindle, which cost about £50, into a Kindle Fire. All you need is a Kindle, some petrol, and a box of matches.
Well, you've got your diamond, and you've got your pretty clothes, and the chauffeur drives your car. You let everybody know, but don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Well, that seems to have done the trick, and I think it's a significant improvement on the original Kindle. Perhaps not quite as good as the iPad, and definitely not as good as a book.
Bearing in mind that your book is being made into an audiobook, are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I do like audiobooks because part of the job running the bookshop requires me to go to travel a lot. So I'm going to people's houses to buy their granny's books after she's died, whatever. So I'm in the car quite a lot, and I mainly listen to Radio 4. But I do quite like an audiobook as well. So although I'm not a huge fan of Tony Robinson, I think he did the Terry Pratchett books extremely well. So those are probably the favourites of what I've read so far, or I've listened to so far as audiobooks.
And will you be able to listen to The Diary of a Bookseller yourself, or will you be cringing behind the steering wheel?
I would undoubtedly be cringing. I'd probably cause a massive pile-up on the motorway or something. So I've had to reread it and rewrite it several times. So I'm pretty sick of it by now, to be honest. And I do read bits of it and think, oh my God, how could I have written that rubbish? But other people seem to like it, so as long as that trend continues, I'll be happy.
Well, as I say, it seems to be flying off the bookshelves here. I'm very much looking forward to listening to it as a talking book and any sequel that you may come up with. Presumably there is more material coming in every day.
Absolutely, and I'll be writing about meeting you in today's entry. So I've kept it going for, well, it's still going, and the year that's been published covers 2014, February 2014 to 2015. So I'm currently rewriting the second year, and I've got to send that to my agents. I said I'd do it before the festival, but I just haven't had time. So hopefully there will be at least one sequel, but I'm not banking on it.
Well, I'll keep my fingers crossed, and I'll see you again next year for an update. Sean, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll bring you a clip of that book as soon as it's released. Now, a book you can get now is the audio version of Want You Gone by Chris Brookmeyer. It's narrated by Avita Jay and Angus King.
I have rehearsed what I am going to say, gone over it and over it in front of the bedroom mirror. I know my arguments and have tried to anticipate how the officials might respond. I was feeling ready when I left the house, coaching myself all the way here. But now, I think I've got no chance. I'm wasting my time. I want to leave, want to run, but I can't. I need the money. I desperately need the money. I glance towards the counter. Above the woman on reception, there is a poster stating, "In the UK illegally, go home or face arrest." Bold text proudly announces there were 86 arrests last week in this area. There are no people on this poster, but if there were, I know what they would look like. They would look like me.
Avita Jay reading from Want You Gone by Chris Brookmeyer. I met Chris at the Wigtown Book Festival and asked him about Want You Gone.
It's the 8th Jack Parlamine book, and it's a heist story. But it's also about hacking, because every hack is a heist, and every heist is a hack. It's all about subverting security, but it's also about a 19-year-old girl that is quite shy and easily intimidated, and she wants to go off to uni, but just when she's about to, her mum gets into big trouble, and she's left looking after her younger sister, who's got Down syndrome. So instead of going to uni, she's taking on a really rotten job and dealing with the benefits system. And then she gets blackmailed by a hacker who's got compromising information on her. And so she's blackmailed into committing a crime, and Parlabane's blackmailed into committing a crime, and they kind of have to join forces to pull off this very audacious heist. So it's about the dangers of anonymity online, that you don't know who you're dealing with. But also, the upside of that anonymity is that somebody who's quite powerless in the real world can find ways to fight back in the online world.
Hacking is much more of a psychological exercise, much more talking to someone and trying to get them to reveal information.
Yeah, they call it social engineering, and it's often done very incrementally. It can be a kind of long con job, you know, that they can do their research, and rather than all sorts of technical bells and whistles, it's often about getting somebody to reveal information, the value of which they don't appreciate. And it can be done by the most subtle ways. There was a way that I put in the book, and I thought this might get criticised for being old hat, which was putting USB sticks, you know, leaving USB sticks around waiting for people to pick them up. And you put the USB stick into your computer and there's malware on it. It's a standard practice to tell people to not put, you know, USB sticks that the provenance of which they don't know. But it turned out that during the US election, one of the ways the Russians hacked the Democratic National Convention was they used the same trick, but instead of leaving USB sticks, they made the people pay for them. What they did was it's really clever psychology, but they flooded the local area, all the newspaper stands, with really cheap USB sticks, so that people are buying it new, thinking they're buying something new and therefore safe, and the malware was already on it when they bought the USB sticks, thinking, oh, you know, $10 for 24 gigabytes. So it's always, it's like one of those things you say, well, how do you protect against it? Well, a lot of the time you can't, because they're always, you know, the successful hack will be a means of exploiting your own psychology in a way that you didn't anticipate.
But is this the last time we'll see Parlamain for a wee while?
There'll be a wee gap. I've got a new book out in November that's a crime novel set in space. So that's a slight shift in genre, because it's science fiction, but it's also a crime thriller. You know, it's not a aliens and ray guns type of sci-fi book. It's a very noir story called Places in the Darkness. But there will be Parlamain again, probably 2019. The 2018 book is coming out in 2017, just to be confusing, because it's been published by Orbit. Their schedule's slightly different, so they'll want You Gone came out in spring 17. This is coming out in November 17, so there'll be no book in 2018, but Parlamain will be back.
Do you think it was inevitable that there was going to be a Chris Brookmyre book set in space?
It's something I've always wanted to do, so yeah, it was a question just getting around to it. Sometimes it's about giving yourself permission to do something. And that's what happened. I think after many, many years, I realised, actually, this is a good idea. I will go for it. It's going to require an American narrator, because it's essentially a kind of female buddy cop thriller with two women that don't like each other very much, but the narration is split between the two of them. So, and they're both originally from LA. The other one has lived all over the world, but she's probably going to have an American accent for convenience, because it'll be the same narrator.
Thanks once again to Christopher Brookmyre. Many of his books are available from the RNIB Talking Book Service. And here's some more information.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss, and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On Air, recorded on location at the Wigtown Book Festival. Now, it's time to go husband hunting with Anda Corsi. She talked to Red Sail.
Anda Corsi, welcome to Read On Air.
Hello, Red. It's very nice to be with you. My book came out 2 or 3 months ago. Its subtitle does quite a lot of explaining what it's about. It's The Husband Hunters, Social Climbing in London and New York.
It's a subject I knew a little bit about, because I've always rather liked Evelyn Waugh novels, and American heiresses on the hunt for a broke baronet seem to pop up quite a lot there. Were there many of them coming over to England?
My book is actually set between 1870 and, I suppose, 1905, when a huge influx of American girls, about 100, married into the peerage. It was a kind of almost like a gold rush. Well, the gold was on their side. They brought it over. But an awful lot of them came over, and the real reason was because very often they were made to by their mothers, who were the real husband hunters, because their mothers wanted to get into New York society. And you couldn't get into New York society if you didn't know Mrs. Astor. And if Mrs. Astor didn't want to know you, she didn't know you. But she would never refuse to know the mother-in-law of a duke.
Oh, so it really was as acquisitive as that to get into the right salon.
It was absolutely like that. I mean, post-American Civil War, enormous fortunes were made in America, because the South had to be reconstructed, railways had to be reconstructed, iron, metal, army supplied, all kinds of things. So there were a whole lot of hugely rich men, and they were married to women who were equally competitive, I suppose, but their only battlefield was the drawing room, the salon, and they wanted to get into New York society. And they fought and fought to do so, but they were regarded by old New York as very nouveau. They were called the bouncers, some of them. And very often their daughters were their weapons. If you had a beautiful daughter, she could marry up, as they say. And sometimes she married into an old American family, in which case you were all right. But other times she had to go farther afield, and that's what started the rush to Europe. And then after the Franco-German War, first they went to France, where they were welcomed to the court of the Empress Eugenie. As long as you were rich, beautiful, and beautifully dressed, you were very welcome there. But after the Franco-German War, they had to look further afield. And they managed to get an entree into England. And quite a bit of that was due to the Prince of Wales, who loved American women, as did a lot of people, because they had very special qualities.
And so they were welcome. Were many of the marriages successful?
Somewhere. The marriages that were successful were there were one or two that were actually for love, like Jenny Churchill and Lord Randolph Churchill, who proposed to her 3 days after he saw her. And they married. There was great opposition from both families at first, but they managed to marry. But an awful lot were not happy, because there you were, a beautiful, rich, young, fated American girl in your own country. And to leave your family, your friends, everybody you knew, to come over to a country that had fairly cold and damp, that hadn't heard of central heating, the plumbing was rather shaky, to say the least, and to live in a society with a husband who took over all your money, it all went straight into his pocket, and where you were treated, unlike in America, you were very much treated as the subsidiary, the second-class citizen. They were not used to that. They were no longer princesses. They were adjuncts. And it didn't always go down very well.
And I suppose a lot of them were living in rather tumble-down ancestral homes that needed a lot of money, or a lot of their money, to put right, which can't have been particularly luxurious for them.
Well, that's perfectly true. I mean, Consuelo Vanderbilt, when she married the Duke of Marlborough, the Marlboroughs were on the pitch, on the edge of being really broke. And even during the honeymoon, he was spending the enormous dowry she had brought with her. Well, I mean, the results you can see in Blenheim today, it's wonderful. But their dowries went straight into these places, and it's true, they kept a lot of these places absolutely going. Some of them, let's face it, took to it like a duck to water. May Galette, who married the Duke of Roxburgh, she was older, she knew her own mind, she was 25 as opposed to 20, so she'd seen quite a lot of the world, and she had made up her mind that really, with her looks and her money, nothing but a duke would do, but he would have to be a rather special duke. And the Duke of Roxburgh was very good-looking, very nice, had a wonderful place. She married him and was very happy. There were so many of them. There were actually advertisements in the papers from indigent peers or baronets seeking ladies with a fortune of no less than whatever it is. I will treat you in all respects properly. I will never disclose what happened, but the fortune must be whatever. You know, and one enterprising American journalist pretended she was an heiress and came over and put advertisements in the paper, and she got a flock of replies. And to her great surprise, when she actually went to interview some of these people, she said they were exactly what they said they were. But she didn't take any of them up. She wrote it up for her paper, but it was, you know, you would see advertisements in the Daily Telegraph for an American heiress.
I'm struck by the similarities in some ways to another one of your books, The Fishing Fleet, which describes how young women were sent out from Britain to India from the 1830s onward.
They really started, actually, from, I think, the early 1600s. It was a 300-year spell. And the first lot were sent out, this was the fishing fleet, the first lot were actually sent out because the East India Company It was voyages then took about 6 months and no real certainty you'd get there. They were terrible voyages, so that they didn't come back on leave. Men didn't come back on leave. And a lot of them married or had liaison with Indian women, but quite a lot wanted a British bride. And sometimes orphans of good family who'd got no money and no prospects in England would be sent out there. These girls were sent out, the early ones, and they were fed and clothed by the East India Company for a year. And during that year, the pretty ones, the nice ones, they were snapped up incredibly quickly. I mean, one who was widowed when her husband got cholera was actually proposed to as she came out of the funeral. They really were snapped up. But the ones who were too nasty or too plain or too awful even to find husbands in the depths of the province were sent back at the end of the year, and they were called returned empties, which is not very nice.
Very sad.
Yes.
And I know from talking to you last night that your new book is really quite exciting. It's The Life and Times of Coco Chanel.
Yes, it's going to be called Chanel's Riviera, and it's about the years 1930 to 1944. In 1930, Chanel put down roots on the Riviera in the shape of her first and only house. It was a sanctuary. It was called La Pausa, and she went there every year. You see, from 1934 onwards, she lived in the Ritz. She lived in an hotel. So it was her only real home. And the Riviera during the 30s, it was incredibly glamorous at first. And then, of course, all these shadows from the coming war. And then you get from June 1940, when the armistice was signed between France and Germany, then you get this terrible oppression of the Jews by Vichy France. And so I've been researching the stories of some of the ones who they came to the Riviera because they thought it would be safe, you see. And they came into these terrible difficulties. They weren't even allowed to earn a living. So I've been researching some of their stories. So you have the glitter, first of all, and then you have the very dark shadows, and then comes the liberation.
And she, of course, was a woman who came from nothing, died very rich, very successful, but again used her beguiling looks and personality to forward her ambition.
Absolutely, and her talent. I mean, that was the great thing. She had this genius, really. I mean, she was an innovator. She produced quite different clothes from before. That's what put her on the map. As opposed to the flounces, the frills, the endless goffering and pleating and ironing and ribbons and frills. She produced simple clothes that women could move in. They could, if need be, in a Chanel suit, you can run for a bus quite happily. You could never have done it before. Sort of starkly elegant, but she softened those with wonderful ropes of beads, precious stones, semi-precious, fake. She didn't mind as long as they looked good. So it was a kind of luxurious simplicity was, I suppose you'd say, her keynote, both when she did up houses. She did up not only her own house, but the Duke of Westminster's house. And in fact, she did up his house in Scotland. You may be interested to know that she introduced the first bidet to Scotland.
You do find out some wonderful facts in your research. Are you planning a trip to the Riviera whilst you write the book?
Oh, yes, I'm going to the Riviera, and I'm happy to say I've had countless offers of assistance if I wish to go.
Oh, somebody got in there before me, did they?
Yes.
Well, Anne de Courcy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Red. It was a pleasure.
Thanks once again to Anne de Courcy, and she'll be back on a future show telling us the books of her life. This edition of Read On Air is recorded on location at the Wigtown Book Festival. And next up, we'll be talking to Adam McQueen. His book, The Lies of the Land, A Brief History of Political Dishonesty, says trust in our politicians is at an all-time low. We're in a post-truth era where feelings trump facts and where brazen rhetoric beats honesty. But do politicians lie more than they used to? And do we even want them to tell the truth? Red Sail finds out more.
So I've caught up with Adam McQueen just after his talk about his fascinating new book, The Lies of the Land, how political misinformation has been fed to the public over the years. Adam works for Private Eye, and, well, you told us some real whoppers there.
Yeah, I did my best. We covered a lot of them. We covered Boris Johnson in great depth. Since he's helpfully, in the last week, resurrected the £350 million to the EU lie, possibly not just to plug my book, but I thought we'd take the opportunity. We covered a little bit of Trump. We only really scraped the surface of Trump, but then maybe that's one for the paperback to really get in depth with that one. We did Archer, we did Aitken, we even went back to Profumo and Suez, because the book goes all the way back to 1953 and Winston Churchill, so pretty comprehensive.
Do you have a favourite political lie that you've uncovered in the researching the book?
I think my favourite story in there would have to be Jeffrey Archer, just because it's got the perfect arc to it. So many of them end up unresolved. They're frustrating and justice is never done. But with Archer, he does finally, the justice catches up with him for all of his lies and he does end up getting sent to prison. As Stuart pointed out in the speech, he then gets three best-selling books out of it and doesn't seem to have harmed him very much at all. But my favourite thing about that is he got caught by the same trick twice, 20 years apart, the News of the World, basically putting someone on the phone with him and recording it, and he just gave them all the evidence they needed on both occasions, which is just the most fantastic downfall for such a horribly bumptious man.
And that, of course, is part of the joy of these political lies being uncovered. You know, these big beasts fall a very long way and make a big indentation in the ground when they hit it.
They do, except in the cases when they get away with it forever. I mean, it was extraordinary researching this, and I was sort of fortunate in... I was fortunate at the time it was commissioned, because the topic of political lying and fake news and post-truth is very, very kind of now. But I was also fortunate in that it had time for two biographies of Jeremy Thorpe to come out, which revealed that, extraordinary line, I found myself saying the talk, that the attempted murder wasn't even the half of it. He'd been behaving in such an extraordinarily risky way for so many years, back in the days when homosexuality was still illegal in the 1960s, sending love letters on House of Commons notepaper to boyfriends in San Francisco, which were then intercepted by the FBI and things like that. It's extraordinary that sort of level of detail that the libel lawyers would not have allowed me to put in a few years ago.
And a bit like the banks in 2007, some of these people just seem to believe that they are too big to fall.
They do, and they will carry on doing so. I mean, we talked about Tony Blair and the WMDs, which I say in the book I don't believe was a lie, but I think by that point Blair was beyond any sort of ideas of lies and truth and evidence. He knew what he believed, and everything else could be made to fit around it. And indeed, in his biography, which I had to read, one of the more unpleasant tasks of my research, he's still banging away at it. He still says that he thinks at some deeper level, which has not yet been discovered, there was a trade in WMDs from rogue states like Saddam Hussein's Iraq to groups like Al-Qaeda. So he still believes it.
And in the 20 years that you've been working for Private Eye, have you seen much change in the way that stories are manufactured and come to light?
Well, the thing about working at Private Eye is you're there for the long haul. So what I have seen in those 20 years is stories that we were banging on about, which seemed very sort of out there and non-mainstream, suddenly get catapulted onto front pages 10 years after we were banging on about them. And the big one of that is tax avoidance, which we've been writing about, elaborate tax avoidance schemes by big companies like Starbucks and various others for years and years and years. And then suddenly, sort of ahead of the last election, this became a massive mainstream news story with lots of newspapers trumpeting exclusives. And we found ourselves, as we quite often do at Private Eye, saying, hang on, didn't we do that story quite a long time ago?
And finally, on today's show, it's time for Books of My Life. Peggy Hughes is the director of Literary Dundee and chairs events with authors all over Scotland and beyond, which indeed is why she was at the Wigtown Book Festival. Before we get to Books of Our Life, Peggy told me about Literary Dundee.
Literary Dundee is based in Dundee, comes out of the University of Dundee, so which just means I have a big community of brilliant academics and students to work with alongside, you know, working with city partners and readers and writers from both communities, really. And so we organise the Dundee Literary Festival, which happens in October, as well as other projects and events and so on year-round. We've had some absolutely wonderful visitors over the years. We've had Janice Galloway, Jackie Kay, James Kilman, the huge big TVs or megastars like Mick Frost and Alan Cumming. We've had loads of fantastic debut authors and especially those coming through the university, which I always find especially exciting because you see them at the start of their journey as writers and then you see them, you know, again a little bit further along the path, mm-hmm. and that's quite lovely to see them grow in confidence and in talent and all that and build a network. So I suppose for me, yeah, the festival is always at the front of the thing for me, really. I love festivals, hence why I'm here in Wigton.
Now, you've got an obvious love of reading, and we have a section on the show where we ask people about the books of their life. Three books, one from childhood, okay. one for a rainy day, and something that's you've read quite recently. So is there a book from childhood that you think maybe inspired your love of reading?
Yes, there absolutely is. Well, I was a really precocious book swatty little bookworm and did read lots when I was little, but the book for me then, I'm sure you'll have had this answer before, is Matilda by Roald Dahl, which is also about a book swatty little bookworm and her love of books and going to the library and having read everything and what else could she read. So I think that's just that's a pretty common book lover's book, but you know, you read to know you're not alone, and when you see yourself as a little kind of girl who loves to read in a book, then that's a very exciting and special thing.
The village school for younger children was a bleak brick building called Crunchham Hall Primary School. It had about 250 pupils, aged from 5 to just under 12 years old. The head teacher, the boss, the supreme commander of this establishment, was a formidable middle-aged lady whose name was Miss Trunchbull. But naturally, Matilda was put in the bottom class, where there were about 18 other small boys and girls about the same age as her. Their teacher was called Miss Honey, and she could not have been more than 23 or 24. She had a lovely pale oval Madonna face, with blue eyes, and her hair was light brown. And her body was so slim and fragile, one got the feeling that if she fell over, she would smash into 1,000 pieces, like a porcelain figure.
Matilda from the RNIB Talking Books Library by Roald Dahl and read by Jean Ford. There's also a Welsh language version read by Hannah Jarman. And what about a book that you would curl up with on a rainy day?
That's a harder proposition because I'm not really a rereader. Do you know what I mean? I'm not really someone who would necessarily return to books, but here is my admission. So I'm a huge fan of Judi Dench, and when I used to do my any time I had to study for exams, I always found myself reading a biography of Judi Dench. So I suppose that's a very comfortable book to me because I've read it so many times and know her life quite intimately. So, but yeah, she just had this wonderful life, and I think she's a wonderful actor. So there we are.
The book Darling Judy, a celebration of Judi Dench, which is edited by John Miller, is unfortunately not available as an audio download, but you may be able to find it on CD. But available from RNIB Talking Books is And Furthermore, Judi Dench's autobiography, read by Jane Markham.
I do not consider this an autobiography. I have neither the time nor the skill to write one. And John Miller has covered much of my life in his 1998 biography, the 70th birthday book from my friends, which he edited, and the illustrated Scenes from My Life we assembled together. So when Ian Truin approached me about this new volume, I hesitated for a long while. Eventually, he persuaded me that, told in my own voice, filling gaps and remembering much that John Miller did not know or did not include in his biography, was more than sufficient justification for a new and updated account. I said that I supposed, in that case, we might entitle it And Furthermore, as a follow-up to those earlier books. I hasten to add that this is also not the final word, since I've often expressed the wish to emulate my dear friends and mentors, John Gielgud and Peggy Ashcroft, both of whom continued working right to the end. I have enjoyed, and am still enjoying, a wonderful life, and made some friendships I cherish deeply, many of which appear in these pages. And that is one of the most important reasons why I am happy to put all this on the record.
And something you've read recently that you'd recommend?
I do tons of reading for my work, and it's funny, I think when you work with books, you sort of more seldom have the opportunity to read purely for pleasure, if that makes sense, although a lot of the reading you do for work is pleasurable. But I suppose the book I've read most recently that I would love to tell people about is by Rebecca Solnit, and she's American. She's, I guess, a thinker and an intellectual and a commentator on life today and so on. But this book's from a few years ago, actually. It's called The Faraway Nearby, and it's just really lovely. It's a non-fiction sort of series of essays. Hard to condense. It reflects on lots and lots of different things, but it's about her childhood and her love of travel and the Arctic Circle and hope, and it's about loads of things, and I loved it.
What's your story? It's all in the telling. Stories are compasses in architecture. We navigate by them. We build our sanctuaries and our prisons out of them. And to be without a story is to be lost in the vastness of a world that spreads in all directions like Arctic tundra or sea ice. To love someone is to put yourself in their place, we say, which is to put yourself in their story or figure out how to tell yourself their story. Which means that a place is a story and stories are geography. And empathy is, first of all, an act of imagination, a storyteller's art, and then a way of traveling from here to there. What is it like to be the old man silenced by a stroke, the young man facing the executioner, the woman walking across the border, the child on the roller coaster, the person you've only read about, or the one next to you in bed?
The Faraway Nearby, read by the author herself, is available commercially now. And thanks once again to Peggy Hughes. For more information on the Dundee Literary Festival, head to literarydundee.co.uk. And today's show wasn't all that we recorded at the Wigtown Book Festival, so listen out for some more great author interviews in future editions of Read On Air.
Well, that was a packed show.
Yeah, kept us on our feet and out of the pub.
For some of the time.
But that's all we've got time for this week. Don't forget that if you want to catch up with this show or any of our previous shows, you can go to our Audioboom page.
At www.audioboom.com, just type in RNIB. There you'll find this show and other great content from RNIB Connect Radio.
And all it remains for me to do now is to thank all our guests, and Robert for making sure that I found and interviewed the right people.
Read On Air will be back at the same time next week. For more information, head to rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to read on.